evening, everyone. Good to see everybody back. Hope you had a pleasant Sunday afternoon, Lord's Day afternoon. Well, I guess I'll just let you know right up front that tonight's lesson has really only one point. But you might want to hold your applause because I want to take some time in getting to that point and getting to it so as to make sure that we understand certain things that we need to understand in order to grasp the seriousness of that single point. You know, in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 15, Paul instructs Timothy and us to study or be diligent so that we might be able to show ourselves approved unto God. And such study will, according to the same verse, help us to learn to rightly divide the word of truth. And I do believe that this notion of rightly dividing the word of truth, though it is not necessarily limited to this, but it does include the idea of recognizing and being able to distinguish between the laws of God as they have applied at different times in man's history on earth, the different eras of man's history on earth. As man has moved through history, he has seen from time to time changes in what God has required of him at these different times and in these different dispensations of history. A person who is truly diligent in their study of the Bible is aware of this fact and recognizes that such changes have taken place over the course of history. These changes, as it turns out, if you study the Word, you learn that these changes were part of the plan of God all along. The Scriptures reveal that God did have a plan for mankind's redemption that was implemented at the time when man acted in a way that caused him to need redemption, almost from the very beginning. I don't know at what point in history the sin in the garden took place. I can narrow it down to the first 130 years of human history because Adam was 130 years old when he had Seth, and that had, the sin had already occurred by that time. But really, knowing the precise time at which it took place is less important than knowing that it did result in God implementing what we call the scheme of redemption. And from our perspective, in these last days in which we live, we can look back over history and see that the unfolding of this great plan did involve certain changes being made at certain points in the plan's unfolding. Think about what we see as the Bible story unfolds before us. We've noted before, quite recently actually, that the history of man on earth can be divided into these three distinct areas. We talked about this some last week, actually. There is the patriarchal era, which began at creation. It is, of course, the earliest dispensation, the earliest era of man's history on earth. And we know that at that time, during that period, that God had a law that he had made clear to man, that he had revealed to man at that time. Now, that law has not been preserved for us, nor has it been revealed in the precise detail as to how God revealed it, but we know that he did. We know that God revealed the law. There's a couple of different ways that we can know that the law was revealed. One was by virtue of the fact that man was sinning from those early days, which means there had to be a law. But another is the one that I want to focus on for a moment here, because we're told in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 4 that it was by faith that Abel offered that sacrifice that was pleasing to God, that was better than his brother Cain's. It was by faith that he did that. Well, how do you come by faith? Romans 10 and verse 17 tells us that faith comes by hearing the word of God. And so Abel had to have heard the word of God, even living in earliest history as he did, in order to offer this excellent sacrifice by faith. The law of God that was revealed in those days was the law to which all humanity was subject. And that remained so for thousands of years, as, as we've talked about before. Just last week we noted that, for example, you look at the book of Genesis, and that single book covers more history than all of the other books of the Bible combined. So for thousands of years we see righteous men and women living according to this law that was given to mankind in this earliest period of human history. And you know, I imagine that after a couple of thousand years of this, those righteous men and women to whom the will of God mattered got pretty used to doing things a certain way. The way that they knew and that they'd been taught was God's way. And yet, after many, many years, eventually another law was given. A law was given at Mount Sinai, coinciding with the second era of human history, what we call the Mosaic, or the Mosaic era or dispensation. Now, as we noted last week, this law was not given to all humanity. It was not binding upon all nations on earth, but to the nation that it was given, the nation of Israel, it was binding. And if we assume that at least some of the people to whom this new law was given had been trying to remain faithful to the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and live according to the law that he had given from the earliest days of man's existence, well, then we've got a situation now where people to whom serving God mattered had to start serving God in ways that they had not served him before. They had to adapt to this new law that they were given, because the law that Israel received at Sinai did involve certain changes to the ways that they were to serve him from that point in history moving forward. Particularly, that generation that came out of Egypt, that traveled to Sinai to receive that law, as well as their children, the next children that entered, or the next generation that entered the land of Canaan, they were instructed to do several things differently than what they may have been used to doing up to that point in time. For example, under this new law given at Sinai, the location of worship, where you offered your sacrifices, would matter. Under the prior law, men set up altars for worship pretty much anywhere. I mean, you think about Abraham and follow Abraham's life. Pretty much wherever Abraham went, you know what he did? He set up an altar to worship God. And that's what righteous men did for thousands of years, including the descendants of Abraham, such as righteous Israel. But under the law given at Sinai, this would no longer be the case. In Deuteronomy chapter 12, Moses points out that the requirement regarding the place of worship under this law would represent a change from what the people may have been used to. In Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 8, beginning there, Moses says, "You shall not at all do as we are doing here today, every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes. For as yet you have not come to rest, to the rest and the inheritance which the Lord your God is giving you. But when you cross over the Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies round about, so that you dwell in safety, then there will be the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. There you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings and sacrifices, your tithes, the heath offerings of your land, and all your choice offerings which you vow to the Lord." Once they were settled in the land, certain requirements regarding the place of worship would go into effect. Requirements that had not been in effect previously. You think about it, over 1,000 years later, in the Gospel of John, when Jesus spoke to the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4, the woman that Jesus was speaking to even acknowledged to Jesus that the Jews said that Jerusalem was the place where one ought to worship. Well, she was right about that as far as the Jews were concerned. The temple in Jerusalem eventually became that place of the Lord's choosing that Moses spoke of, where sacrifices were to be offered. But what I'm noting right now is that this represented a change from the earlier law, the earliest law that God had given to man. And you might have noticed in Moses' words, Moses even acknowledged that this was going to be different than maybe what they had been used to been doing. And I tell you, this would by no means be the only such change that the people would be introduced to. In addition to the location of the sacrifices becoming significant, there would be a special group of people who would oversee the sacrifices, where there had been no such group that were made aware of previously. I'm talking about the priesthood, the Levitical priesthood that was instituted at Sinai. And there would be holy days and holy feasts that were implemented at Sinai that the people would be required to observe under this law. These represented new things to the people to whom the law was given. This law, for the people to whom it applied, would represent quite a few changes like this, as it replaced the law that even they, many of them, had known for generations. And this law that they had known was now going to be replaced by the law given through Moses at Sinai, which had ultimately come from God, supposedly. But what I'm getting at is, in view of all of this, in view of the fact that the law was being, the law that people had known for thousands of years, where the Israelites were concerned, I guess I should say, was being discarded in favor of this new law given by God, it would be perfectly reasonable for a person faced with such a change to want to be sure that these changes were authorized. We're going to start doing things differently now? Well, how can I know that these things that we're going to be doing now are actually authorized by God? When did the law change for the Israelites? Well, it changed when the other law was given at Sinai. But who authorized the change? Because after all, if the previous law had come from God, who would have authority to change that law other than God himself? Well, those of us that have spent some time studying the Bible know that it was God, not only who authorized this new law, but who came up with the new law and simply delivered it through Moses. In Exodus chapter 24, in verse 12, after Israel had arrived at Mount Sinai, and after God had offered the covenant to the people and the people had accepted the covenant, after that ratification by God and the elders of the people, there in Exodus 24 and 12 it is written, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you tablets of stone and the law and commandments which I have written that you may teach them.'" So yeah, you want to make sure that this is authorized by God. God provides you that surety right here. "This is a law that I have written that you are to teach to the people, Moses." Changes were made to the laws and requirements that men had known for many years, at least in Israel. Changes in the law that had been given by God. But that was okay. As we said, these changes were part of the scheme of redemption all along. And what we see in the statement in Exodus 24 is that the newer law was given by God as well. It is true. Only God has the right to make changes in God's laws for anyone. It's just that in this case, that's exactly what God did, according to his plans, according to his purposes. The changes represented by this new law were authorized by God, so it is perfectly all right for the Israelites to start practicing this new law. Now we know that law that was given at Sinai was eventually replaced as well. A new law eventually took effect that applies to all men who lives under the law today, both those who continued under the original law as well as those who lived under the law given at Sinai. And this is, in fact, the law that we live under today, and it coincides with the final dispensation of man's history on earth, the era or the dispensation of Christ. The law that we have been given replaced, for the Jews, the law that was given at Sinai, for everybody else, the law that was given at the beginning. And like the law given at Sinai, then the new law represented some changes, some pretty significant changes to the way things had been done in times past under both the patriarchal and the Mosaic law. So righteous Jews, and I guess we could say righteous men, had to get used to changes to laws that they had known and that they had practiced for thousands of years. That requirement regarding the location of worship, that's another good example. It changed from the patriarchal law to the law given to Israel. Now it has changed again. Speaking of that conversation between Jesus and the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4, after she noted what the Jews believed about where men ought to worship, Jesus did tell her in John chapter 4 and verse 21, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father." Well, that was going to be a significant change for many people who had been practicing a law that God had given them. Not only that, but a new time of worship was declared under this new law. Whereas the law given by God at Sinai called for a worship assembly on the seventh day of the week, we talked about this last week, it's called the Sabbath, this new law calls for a worship assembly on the first day of the week. That came to be known, at least by the time John wrote the book of Revelation, as the Lord's Day. The worship itself would be quite different than what people have been used to under the law of Moses. No animal sacrifices. No blowing of trumpets. No special feast days other than the Lord's Day itself. Again, as was read to us earlier by Ed in Colossians chapter 2, Paul said that no one is to be judged according to these things anymore. The foods, the festivals, the Sabbaths, things of that earlier law, we're not to be judged according to that because that law has been replaced. And changes have thus taken effect regarding what is required of men to serve God in the era of Christ. The final era of man's history on earth. But again, this may very well have been a challenging notion to many righteous people who had been trying to serve God according to former laws for a long, long time. Think of Peter and the vision that God sent him in Acts chapter 10. A vision that was intended to make Peter aware that things had changed now that Christ had come and completed his work. And if you read that account in Acts 10 of the vision that was sent to Peter, you know that there were some aspects of this new reality that were challenging for Peter to wrap his mind around. And I would think that that was the case for a lot of people. And so again, I believe it would be perfectly reasonable for someone at that time, in view of the changes from the law they had known, a law given by God, it would be perfectly reasonable for them to ask, when did the law change? And who authorized this change? Well, again, the question is, who could authorize the change other than God himself? These would be legitimate questions for a person to ask, in view of the fact that people were being asked to accept changes to a law that had been given to them by God. Well, of course, again, as was the case in the days of Moses, there's a legitimate answer to that legitimate question. The answer is that God had authorized these changes. Still there in Colossians 2, Paul goes on to say regarding those things of the former law that they are a shadow of things to come, but the substance is of Christ. It was the Son of God who implemented the new law and the changes it brought about. It was the same Son of God of whom the Father said on the Mount of Transfiguration in Mark 9, "Hear ye him." In other words, the Father was telling us, "Listen to my Son." So yeah, it would be perfectly reasonable, and it is perfectly reasonable, for someone to ask, who has authorized changes to this earlier law that God had given in an earlier era? But the question does have a legitimate answer, that God has authorized such changes in the past, and he's authorized such changes in these last days. What was expected and required by God in times gone by has, in certain detailed ways, changed. But in accordance with God's intent and by God's authority. So what? What is my point in taking note of these facts that are revealed in the pages of Scripture? What I read in the pages of the New Testament is the law that was given by Christ. And of course, Jesus the Christ is himself deity. He is God, which is enough for me to know that the law revealed in the New Testament has God's approval. But as we've noted already, God the Father has weighed in on this subject and stated that what God the Son says in this regard goes. He is the voice of authority. Paul notes in Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 22 that the Father has put all things under his, that is Jesus' feet. And he has given him, Jesus, to be head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. The changes that took place for the Jews when the law of Sinai went into effect were perfectly legitimate because these changes had come from God. And the changes that took place for all men when the law of Christ went into effect, they are perfectly legitimate because they have come from God. God authorized these changes, and he had planned for them all along. So, what about the changes that we've seen since the giving of the law of Christ? Now, I hope a lot of you are going, huh? What are you talking about? What changes since the law of Christ? Well, I'm simply referring to the fact that if you look at what is revealed in the pages of the New Testament, the law of Christ, and compare it to the teachings and practices of many in the religious world today, you're going to note some differences between the two. So observing what is going on in the religious world, a casual observer might take note of that fact. In fact, and might think, well, evidently some changes have taken place since that time. You know, think about certain things that are taught in the law of Christ. The law of Christ speaks of there being but one church. We read in Ephesians 1, or we actually saw from Ephesians 1 a moment ago, that Christ has been made head over all things to the church, which is his body. The body that Paul speaks of in the letter to the Ephesians is the church, and Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 4 tells us there is but one. There is one but one body, one church. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 47, as people were being baptized and saved, Luke writes that the Lord was adding them to the church. One body, one church is spoken of in the law of Christ. And yet you look around today and you see many churches. Something changed somewhere and sometime. Now, I will acknowledge this, and we've acknowledged this before, that because it is not possible for every member of the Lord's church in the world to assemble together on the first day of the week, we do find that different groups of Christians in different geographical areas come together. We see that all around us, even here in our area of Florida. Well, that was the case in the first century. We see in the first century different local assemblies mentioned in the New Testament as well. But let me tell you something about all those different local assemblies. They were practicing the same thing. They were teaching the same doctrine. They were doing the same thing because they'd all been taught the same thing. Paul noted to the Corinthian brethren in 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 17 that he taught the same things everywhere and in every church, as would have all of the apostles, because they were all teaching the same doctrine. Remember what we've noted from Acts chapter 2 and verse 42, where it says that the brethren there in Jerusalem at the beginning continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship. And again, I've noted with you before, it says the apostles, plural, as in all of the apostles, doctrine, singular. They were all teaching the same thing. So all the churches, all these local assemblies that were faithful to the Lord were practicing that singular doctrine that all of the apostles taught. And that doctrine was to be taught exclusively to the exclusion of any others. Paul noted this to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 3 when he said that some needed to be charged not to teach any other doctrine. And this doctrine that was to be taught included several factors in addition to faith that are required for a person to be saved. But if you look at what's being taught in many churches, apparently some changes have taken place to that. The law of Christ says that in addition to faith, salvation is going to require repentance. It's going to require confession. And it's going to require baptism. These are all necessary, according to the law of Christ, in order for a person to be saved by the blood of Christ. But again, you look at the situation today in the religious world, what is being taught and practiced, and you find somebody somewhere along the way has made changes to these things. Many people are perfectly fine with the notion that there are many churches practicing many different doctrines. Many people today are fine with excluding certain things that the New Testament, the law of Christ, has said are necessary in order to be saved. Not only that, but many of these same people are not fine with anyone who would suggest otherwise. And so what I'm saying is that in all of these things, as well as several other things that we could cite, what we see in the religious world today represents a change in the law that was revealed nearly 2,000 years ago and that has been practiced by Christians over the course of that 2,000 years since it was given. Now, we've already noted that when the law that was given to Sinai to the Jews, a law that represented changes to what man had been taught earlier, that it was perfectly reasonable for a Jew to want to know who authorized this change. That it would be perfectly reasonable for them to want some verification that these changes had come from God. Well, God provided verification of that fact. Similarly, when the law of Christ was implemented, and I think we see this on Peter's part in Acts 10, when the law of Christ was implemented, that represented changes to what all men, both Jew and Gentile, had practiced previously. Perfectly reasonable for a person, a righteous person, to want to know and be sure that these changes to a law that God had given, these changes had come from him as well. Well, again, that verification was provided. Among other things, we can note from Mark chapter 16, verse 20, that Mark 16 and 20 tells us that the Lord confirmed through the accompanying signs that the apostles performed that the things that they taught had come from him. It would be perfectly reasonable to want to know that the changes were authorized by God, and God provided verification of that fact. The Lord provided those signs because he knew it was reasonable and even right for people to want to know that these changes had come from him. And so, my point tonight, my single point that I've been driving at since we started this study a few minutes ago, is that in view of the fact that much of what is practiced in the name of Christ today represents a change from what had been revealed in his law as delivered in the first century, I think it's perfectly reasonable for us to want to have some type of verification that these changes have come from him and are authorized by him. So where do we get such verification? When did these laws change after they were given by the Lord? Who authorized these changes? In Matthew chapter 28, in verse 18, Jesus famously declared that all authority had been given to him in heaven and on earth. And we've asked this question before, but let's ask it again. If Jesus has been given all all authority, how much does that leave for anyone else? For any man, for any group of men, for any council, any synod, any convention or association? It leaves none. If there are to be any changes to the law of Christ, they've got to be introduced, and they've got to be authorized, and they've got to be implemented by the Lord Himself. And I am just not aware of any such instructions given by the Lord that indicate that He has done this. Just the opposite, really. Now, many of us are familiar with the closing words of the Bible, the closing words of the book of Revelation. And I do think that John, as he writes that, primarily had in mind what he wrote in the book of Revelation. But I'd also believe that it's a principle that applies to the New Testament as a whole and that is backed up by other passages in the New Testament. But I'm talking about Revelation 22 and beginning in verse 18, where John writes, "For I testify to everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book, if anyone adds to these things, God will add to him the plagues that are written in this book. And if anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God shall take away his part from the book of life, from the holy city, and from the things which are written in this book." God has never given any indication that changes are authorized that he has not introduced or implemented. And he does not take it lightly, I believe, when men presume to make changes to laws that he has given. If we're going to practice things that represent changes to what is revealed in the pages of the New Testament, we had better be able to provide verification that these changes have come from God. And if we cannot provide such verification, and I don't believe that we can, then we just need to stick with what he's revealed and not act presumptuously. And as Paul told the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 6, not think beyond what is written. Do you know what it is called when we insist on doing God's thing in God's way and in the way He's prescribed? I know some people say, well, that's legalism. Personally, I don't have a problem with legalism. Is illegalism better? But anyway, what I'm thinking is when we insist on doing God's things in God's way, we call that obedience. We call that submission, and that's a good thing. According to Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 9, it is obedience that is necessary in order for anyone to be saved. That's why I believe thoughts like these are important. We're not obeying when we presume to make changes that have never been authorized by God. The good news is, though, that anyone who is willing to be obedient, even someone who has been disobedient previously, can still be saved. What we're trying to do here is obey those things that have verifiably come from the Lord in order to help one another get to heaven. And we would love for anyone who is not already involved with us in this and not already joining us on our way to heaven to join us by obeying those things that have been given to us via the law of Christ in the era of Christ. Thank you for your attention this evening. Go ahead and get ready to sing the song that David selected for us. The Lord has made clear in His law given in the era of Christ what is necessary to make oneself fit for heaven. And we can sum it by saying it's going to require obedience to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so if you're here tonight and have never done that, that opportunity is before you now. And we can accommodate you if you have need to be baptized into Christ. Or if you're a child of God that's drifted from the way and you need the help of the church to get back right with the Lord, we stand ready to assist you as well. And we certainly hope that you'll let us help you, even now as we stand and sing together.